everyone. I'm Stephen Roberts, and you're listening to Cancel Cabal on People's Internet Radio.
$4.2 million Americans have now been canceled by their insurance companies.
Canceled your show.
And Futurama's been canceled.
Canceled.
Canceled too soon.
Is officially canceled.
Be canceled twice.
His launch pre-order bundle was canceled. Do we know it's a his?
Have been effectively canceled.
And abruptly canceled.
From Target is canceled.
Or unceremoniously canceled.
The plan was being canceled.
The cabal has been canceled.
Look at the role of the Rothschild family.
Money and power.
Monsanto and a few other chemical companies.
Culling the population through eugenics is their answer.
The World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Trade Organization.
These are the most disgusting people on the face of this earth.
Or they control the information.
The powerful few people who run this planet.
They're not as powerful as you think.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Now brings you Cancel the Cabal with Stephen Roberts. Stephen Roberts.
Red or blue?
All right, welcome everyone. It's Wednesday evening here in America, early Thursday morning in Ireland, Scotland, UK, and elsewhere in Europe. I'm Stephen Roberts, and this is People's Internet Radio's Cancel the Cabal, and I'm also transmitting on PSN Radio out of Miami, Florida, thanks to Angel Espino. So welcome, everyone. I have the lovely and talented Jill Trebilcock with me. Hi, Jill.
Hi, Stephen.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Can you scoot your camera down just a tiny bit? It's cutting half of your face off.
No, oh, that's perfectly useful today.
Since we're going to be doing video in that.
Is it right now? I can't see a thing.
You could, scoot it down a little bit more.
Can we edit that later? Or something? No, we can't. All right.
Yes, we
we'll
can do that later.
We'll happily ever after.
Yes, we can edit that later on.
I think my sticky tape's not working as hard as it's meant to.
No. Doesn't seem to be working at all.
Oh, well, the plot thickens. Okay. This is very exciting, Stephen.
Yes, it is.
We have somebody who's actually studied natural law, lived in Scotland, and is a community rights movement advocate. And we're very lucky, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
Very, very lucky.
Yeah, he was born in Los Angeles, California in 1958. I haven't read all of his bio there, but you must have been studying up on this man we're having on tonight, huh?
Oh, well, absolutely. I'll read a little bit about Paul Cienfuegos now. He was born in 1958 in West LA, California, and when he was five, his family moved to Albuquerque, New Mexico. After high school, he enrolled in college at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, which was an alternative education. So this is like proof of the pudding is in the eating. This is a boy who's had an alternative education from the get-go.
Absolutely.
Yeah. He said it was an absolutely wonderful public alternative in the conventional to the conventional college routine. Since as far back as he can remember, he's been passionate about social change and has devoted most of his life to this important work. In the 1970s, 80s, and early 90s, he worked on numerous issues, including nuclear power, nuclear disarmament, ancient forest protection, bioregionalism, native sovereignty, and local economic development, which is really fascinating in itself. From 1977
I was just going to mention that. He says from 1977 to 79, He led more than a dozen nonviolent direct actions trainings for residents of Olympia, Washington, to help the community play a significant role in a larger effort to stop the opening of the Trident nuclear submarine base in Bangor, Washington. He was arrested there 3 times for civil disobedience actions, but never convicted.
He's a clever one.
Yeah, sounds like a good political activist. And if you're a good political activist, you tend to get arrested and demonized and that kind of thing.
Well, it's a big fight, isn't it? It's an ongoing fight. And so he's a community worker. So basically, that was a very clever thing to do. I think of all the things that I am most interested in, it is community work, because that's a grassroots. And this is the difference between top-down and bottom-up. Like, we're all complaining about the elites and the difficulties of the top-down situation, whereas we, the people, have the power. And I'm really interested, as he studied native sovereignty, and Paul often talks about we, the people, and I really want to ask him how he thinks, you know, one of the perfect marriages of sovereignty and community rights and native rights. So we're sort of really lucky to have him. From 1990 to 1995, he lived in a yurt in Tofino in the rainforest of Clayoquot Sound. I can't pronounce that. Clayoquot Sound on the west coast of Vancouver Island in Western Canada, and worked on and off for Friends of the Clayoquot Sound. In 1994, he discovered pioneering work of Richard Grossman. Like, this is the one, Richard Grossman. He's the big name for everyone to remember in the community rights movement. I'll just finish this paragraph and let you be quiet for a sec for you, Steve. Sorry. And the program of corporations, law, and democracy, which he co-directed, that's Richard Grossman did, and which fundamentally transformed Paul Cienfuegos' social change work. Until then, I had seen nothing wrong with focusing on numerous single issues. After my transformation, I realized that almost every issue I had ever worked with was a mere symptom of corporate rule. Ah, and here comes the man himself.
Possibly, yes. Hello, Paul.
Hi there.
Hi. We've been reading your bio here for the last 4 or 5 minutes here.
Okay.
Waiting to message you. Say hello to Jill, and then say hello to everybody on PSN Radio and People's Internet Radio. You're live on air.
I'm not on yet, hopefully.
Yes, we are.
You are.
Okay, you said I'd be on at 4:15, so I'm not ready.
Oh, okay. All right. I can let you come back in then.
Please, yeah, take me off so I can talk to you.
Okay.
All right. Well, looks as though while you talk to him quietly, Stephen, it seems that Paul has something to say. I can keep reading this if you like.
No. I've got to put a song on or something then.
Oh, okay. And what about We're All in This Together?
I got to find that. Hang on.
Because it's a good one.
Okay.
So the people are being naughty.
I don't have that in my thing right now. I've got to get something else.
All right. Okay.
Okay. Here we go.
Okay, so while you're looking for that, I'll tell you a bit more about Paul.
Hang on a second. I got it. Here we go. Okay, and welcome back, everyone. We've got everything all sorted out. Got our misunderstanding going, so we want to welcome Paul to the show, don't we, Jill?
Yes, Paul Cienfuego, thank you so much for coming. We're very lucky to have your time. Thank you.
I'm happy to be with you folks for a few hours, yes.
It's very exciting. Stephen, do you want to lead? Hey, Paul, you know something about, I've been looking at your bio and you studied native rights. Well, the particular station that I'm affiliated with at the moment is People's Internet Radio, Seeking Sovereign Solutions. And I'm always having trouble trying to work out how to, because I'm new to politics, oddly enough, because I've had no faith in politics all my life, and which which is an interesting story in itself. And you've been a community development worker and had an alternative thing and studied, lived in Scotland and studied native law. Would you like to sort of, and you often speak about we the people and our own sovereignty, would you like to explain how that sort of evolved for you and where you sort of stand in terms of feeling yourself as a sovereign and believing in native law and natural law and nature law, and just marry the whole lot together for us if you possibly can, or explain how it's married in your mind.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Let me just clarify, though, I don't have any professional background in native legal history at all. I worked in the native sovereignty movement just for a year while I was living on the west coast of Vancouver Island in British Columbia, Canada. A couple decades ago, and got very excited in the early 1990s. I was there. I got very excited by the fact that when the empire was starting to conquer native people and settle all of what became Canada, that unlike everywhere else in Canada, British Columbia's elected governments were so fundamentally racist that they refused to make treaties with the native people. They continued to just tell the federal government that they would just kill them instead of make treaties with them. And the federal government was so outraged at this, they actually sent the attorney general twice in the mid-1800s. You can imagine what a difficult trip that was from Ottawa to Victoria. Twice the guy was rebuffed by the provincial leader of British Columbia. And they just kept killing Indians. It was policy. And so now, because of this astonishing racism, most of British Columbia is what they call beyond the treaty frontier, which means there's no treaties in BC, by and large. And that means that the land never was ceded to the conqueror people.
Yes.
It's native land under Canadian law, which is just what Canadians were trying to avoid all the time. And what I was missing there during my years in the wilds of Vancouver Island was the legal and political reality hitting the Canadian government and courts head on, which is that they better start negotiating with native tribes because they actually had stolen it not fair and square. And so that was the beginning of my interest in native sovereignty issues, is discovering that it was a whole region of North America that had never been treated. And some incredibly exciting stuff is now happening in BC because of this, because even the state of Canada acknowledged that there were no treaties, and so they better start paying attention to what the native folks wanted.
That's really interesting, because that's the same in Australia. There's no treaty in Australia either with the original caretakers of the land.
I didn't know that. It's very interesting. Yeah. Mm. So, you know, in the country, there are very few places that aren't treated. It was mostly stolen legally. And so that puts the native folks in a much more dire situation, because they were pushed into these little postage stamp reservations, mostly across the U.S. And then they're disenfranchised even further. The government over the last century tries to disappear tribes and make them take away their treaty status. And so native people have to fight to keep that. But even to this day, you know, a native nation in the United States might claim it has sovereignty. But, you know, a nation that really has sovereignty doesn't have to be accepted by the U.S. government to legally exist. And unfortunately, that's the kind of sovereignty U.S. native nations have. So it's kind of a fake sovereignty. But in the community rights movement, we think it's actually a very powerful mythology that can still be used if there are native leaders who have the backbone. And it's hard to find elected officials, native or non-native, that have the backbone to pass the various kinds of community rights legislation that we're moving pretty rapidly across the U.S. with.
Well, Paul, isn't it really more difficult to try to find politicians on the local level that will actually recognize the community as a sovereignty over and above the corporate fiction?
Well, so far in the community rights movement in the United States, it started in 1999. So far, we've got 160 communities in 9 states that have passed these community rights locally enforceable laws, and the vast majority of them were passed directly by local elected officials, and most of those communities are rural conservative communities. So it actually hasn't been that difficult so far to find at least a majority of elected officials to pass these things, because in pretty much all of these cases, they're trying to stop some pretty horrific corporate proposal to change the whole quality of the community.
It's really extraordinary, and I as you so often tell, because I've watched a lot of your videos, Paul, you begin, what you basically do, it began, as you were saying, with these really straight farmers who were hog farmers when they wanted to bring a 15,000 head of hogs, or however you say that, a huge hog farm into a town, and it got the very conservative people upset. Would you like to say a little tiny bit about that?
Sure. I mean, that was really the beginning of this whole movement. There had been already a movement of people that were doing a lot of historical research and provocative it was a group called the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, or POCLAD. POCLAD.org is their website, and that's who trained me, Richard Grossman and others. And they were asking these very provocative questions about how can it be that we have thousands of organizations working on all of these single issues, and it doesn't seem to add up. All of the ecological, social, economic trajectories are all going off the cliff. But at that time, we didn't have any public interest attorneys who had latched on to this work. It wasn't even yet called the community rights movement. It was just a movement of, it wasn't even a movement yet. It was a bunch of people around the country, disparate people, that were trying to imagine what it would look like to rein in corporate constitutional rights. And in 1999, there was a public interest law firm based in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, and it's called the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. Its name is, the acronym of its name is its website, CELD.org. And this public interest law firm had been working for decades through doing what every environmental attorney pretty much around the country had been doing ever since Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA. For decades, they had been battling one specific corporate proposal through the regulatory system, appealing the permit applications, finding faults with the applications, and that's really been, for decades, the only way that environmental activists really have known how to challenge these corporate proposals that happen all over the country. And these applications is through the regulatory system of law, and that's what the CELDA public attorneys, public interest attorneys, had been doing as well. They had this really quite grand track record of putting off and delaying the approval of all of these permits for hog farms, for all sorts of other things. But the reality on the ground was that you can't actually use the regulatory system effectively to stop anything. And so the farmers in Wells Township, a rural conservative hog farm, family hog farm community of about 550 folks, when they heard they were going to get a factory farm, as you said, with thousands, tens of thousands of hogs, they were not very excited, as you can imagine. And when they tried to figure out where you go to say to the local government or the state government, we don't want this here, assuming that they had the right to stop it, they were just shocked to discover that the only process was the regulatory process, and to regulate means to allow, not to prohibit. And so they were really quite taken aback, because these were patriotic, you know, conservative farmers who believed that we, the people, are the sovereign and that we have authority over our government. And yet there didn't seem to be a single place anywhere in state government where they could say no to a massive factory farm destroying their local community. And CELDEF had been working with them through the permitting process and holding them off, holding the permit off for a few years. And they finally turned to the CELDEF attorneys in 1999 and said, we don't understand why you can't just write us a local ordinance that bans factory farms in our community. And the CELDEF attorneys, you know, why is so complicated? We thought we're in charge. You know, we thought we lived in a democratic republic. And the CELDEF attorney said, well, there's these structures of law in place that make it legally impossible for you to pass laws that protect your health and welfare, because the passing of those laws would violate various state laws and would violate corporations' various constitutional rights. And again, the farmers were stunned, and they said, well, we don't really care if the law that we pass is legal or not. You know,
well, Paul, there is a difference between legal and lawful, though, Paul, and that's what a lot of people don't realize.
I guess I'm not familiar with the difference. Why don't you tell me the difference?
Well, just because something is legal, they can write it on paper and say that they make it legal, but that doesn't mean that it's lawful. There are lots of things. here lately, police brutality is legal. If you're not complying with what they call a lawful order, they are able to beat you into submission legally, but it's definitely not lawful.
So you're speaking about a different sort of law. You're juxtaposing
more of a common
two
law.
Laws.
Yeah, more of a sovereign, common law, more of a natural law.
Right. Okay. And so far, I'm just referring to the local, state, and federal law. Mm. So federal law is talking about lawful or legal then? Which term would you use?
I'm sorry. Say that again.
What would you use, lawful or legal, to describe the laws that exist at the local, state, and federal level?
More than likely legal, but not legal. Not lawful. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I'm not familiar with the distinction, but I'll use the word legal. So just to finish the story, the folks in Wells Township said, we'd love to have you write this ordinance that is not legal. And Seldiff wrote something called the Anti-Corporate Farming Ordinance, and it was passed unanimously by the elected township supervisors in the fall of 1999. And it was the Anti-Corporate Farming Ordinance, something very basic. It banned non-family-owned corporations from engaging in farming or owning farmland. And they gave a very specific definition to what a family-owned corporation was, so it was hard to make the definition and to meet the definition. And they passed this law that was illegal, and the factory farm application was taken off the table, and the company left. And very rapidly, word spread across Pennsylvania, and within a handful of years, 20 other conservative rural farm communities had passed the Anti-Corporate Farming Ordinance to also stop factory farming there, and not a single one ended up with a factory farm. And it just took off from there.
I'd like to add to something which I think you just said a minute ago. They passed a law that was not legal. I think they passed a law that was not legal in their own mind.
They passed a law that violated state preemption laws and violated the federal constitution. An interpretation of the federal constitution.
Right, but it gave power to the community and the people in that community, though didn't
absolutely.
It? Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's
really why they called it illegal.
What's that?
That's why they referred to it as illegal. I'm almost betting.
Oh, well, anyway, look, we're splitting hairs here.
Well,
yeah, we don't need to split these hairs, do we?
I'm just trying to maybe get a better grasp on what's going on, and I don't know. I'm just trying to add a little commentary to it, Jill.
No, that's good, Stephen. Well, look, if you had a situation, just let's go completely off to one side, Paul. At the moment in Ireland, they're having trouble with water meters being installed on by Irish Water. Do you know anything about that?
I don't, no.
No. Well, let's pretend that you have
a... It's kind of like the same thing that's going over here with the...
Smart meters,
yeah. They're going around communities and passing what they call laws, making it legal making it illegal if you don't have a smart meter. That's what they're doing over there with the water meters. They are trying to charge people that have their own wells for water. And they're trying to charge, I think, inner city. I'm not totally positive on the entire story, but they're trying to charge for water. And it's basically the same thing over here, like with the smart meters. They're making it illegal if you don't have a smart meter, or they're making it illegal if you don't have the old-fashioned filament light bulbs. Is it right? I mean, these things are, you know, they're trying to make it illegal over there for people to get fresh water, non-fluoridated water.
Well, it's illegal in most states in the United States to collect rainwater off your roof.
Exactly. But
you know, it's amazing what is illegal in the United States.
That's what I'm saying. Illegal and lawful are two different things. Is it right? Yeah. No, it's not.
No, of course not. And the movement that I'm part of is violating unjust state and federal law very purposefully and very publicly.
Yeah, great. Absolutely. Go ahead, Jill.
So, Paul, how would you go about organizing on a community rights level against something like, what experience do you have with people organizing against something like smart meters? What's a community rights-based way to go about that? What's been happening?
There hasn't been any organizing through the community rights framework about smart meters. There's no reason there couldn't be, but the work that's happened so far in the 160 communities that have passed these ordinances is that they have banned fracking in about a dozen and a half communities. They've banned water withdrawal for bottling in a handful of communities. What's that?
I'm really passionate about that. That's what I want to do. I live in a very rich mineral water area, and Coca-Cola takes a lot of our water from a place called Mount Franklin, which is where I live. I can see Mount Franklin from the top of my hill. Mount Franklin mineral water, or Hepburn Springs mineral water, and I really want to work out how to go about protecting the local water and stopping the Coca-Cola from taking water from our little village in Victoria, Australia.
Well, two communities in rural Maine passed community rights ordinances that banned corporations from extracting water for bottling. And both of those communities stopped a Nestle Poland Springs brand, which is a Nestle product, bottling plants in both communities. Again, the application was withdrawn.
Nestle was taking water from one of the Great Lakes too, weren't they?
Who was? Sorry?
Nestle.
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I mean, Nestle's all over the country. I wouldn't be surprised. You know, I mean, the corporate takeover of water is an almost entirely completed process already.
Well, I heard like about 3 or 4 years back that water was going to be the next gold.
Water is the next oil.
Oil and gold, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, have they actually ever stopped people from taking water with existing contracts, or are you talking about proposals there?
The community rights ordinances could actually stop existing on-the-ground corporate stuff. No ordinances have been passed yet that do that. Right. But you actually could withdraw the right of a corporation to be doing the business they're doing in the first place in your town or city or county, yes, using these ordinances. And there's also the capacity to use our eminent domain authority to seize corporate property and put it to a different use. And that has also not been done yet anywhere in the U.S., but on the CELDEF website, there is an eminent domain ordinance already drafted for use.
Oh, absolutely fabulous. So that website, there's two really important questions I have regarding that, and that is I'm interested in what lawyers you use, because I know you have a team. I think you may have mentioned them before, but I didn't get a chance to write them down. But you have lawyers who are actually quite sort of practiced in writing these municipal ordinances.
Yes, and that's, again, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDEF.org.
Right.
That is the team of lawyers.
Yep.
It's a pretty remarkable group that, with a total staff of about 15 folks around the United States, and only a few of them are attorneys. Most of them are grassroots organizers, local organizers, and their office is in rural Pennsylvania. And I'm a partner of CELDEF. I don't work with them. I don't work for them. I work with them. And then they have contract attorneys as well. And you know, if they had more funds coming in, they'd have even more attorneys working for them. But they're a foundation, and they're basically grant and donation funded. They don't charge for their legal services at all. Once a community hires CELDEF, they come in and they lead what's called a democracy school, which is a weekend training, and they form a contractual relationship with that community and help the community write their ordinance and around the specificity that the community needs. And then they help to defend it if there's ever a lawsuit against it. And they do all of that for free.
Absolutely wonderful people. Well, we had a very good QC save the Barrier Reef recently in Australia from some work like that. And he's become a bit of an Australian legend. So, Paul, what would one of you're also working on the community rights bill? Do they go hand in hand, or I mean, does everybody? You know, we all could. How when you write a community rights bill, and I was looking at some of the ones that you've written, do they have a basis? What's the basis?
You're talking about the local ordinances, the local laws.
I'm talking about two things at once. Sorry to do this to you. I'm trying to, you know, sort of hone into the center of your knowledge. And that is about, community rights, community bills of rights. You're quite sort of, into them, right?
That is the entire movement, is passing local laws or ordinances. Yes. Those are the laws that are the movement. Yes.
Yeah. And then based on, a community bill of rights. So they are, the ordinances are within the community bill of rights. Is that what you're saying?
No, actually they are the same thing. The community bill of rights is the ordinance.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. I get it. That makes sense. So you must feel very positive because what you're doing, I actually did do community development work and sociology and, but I don't live it as much as I would like to live it. Like you're living it. So good on you, Paul.
Yeah, thank you. It's quite an exciting life to actually be doing what you want full time with your life and surviving financially at the same time.
Yeah. I bet it is.
St. Paul. If at any time you need a break or anything, just let me know and I'll do something.
Okay.
But otherwise, I was going to wait until the hour here.
Sure, I'm fine.
Go ahead, Jill. You got more?
Well, it's just all coming out of my head. As long as I can just sort of smooth into it.
So, it is mine too. It is mine too. I've got something quick here. Most of us know. I'm not going to assume that you know, but I've heard you talk about the corporate fiction and just all of the different aspects of the illusion. The police in any district or community or whatever it be are nothing but hired bodyguards for the corporate entity. I wonder if something can be done on a local level to stop the tyrannical ways of the corporate bullies.
Well, I mean, that's exactly what we are doing. So yes, of course, something can be done. And that's, I think the community rights movement is perhaps the most powerful aspect of that that's appeared in the United States for some time. I mean, the work that we're doing is about, ultimately, it's not just about, it's not just legal work. It's really much more about culture shift work. And I keep hearing, are you asking me a question? I'm confused.
Well, I just wanted to know about, I wanted to know about the private bullies for the city or the
state. Okay, I was hearing you talking and I thought maybe I was missing another question. So really what the work is about is, and that's why most of what I'm doing is teaching around the United States in local communities, is helping people to reimagine the proper relationship between we the people and our institutions, our subordinate institutions, be they our governmental institutions or our corporate business legal fiction institutions. Well, I mean, government is a legal fiction also. So, you know, right now, when most people think about a Monsanto or an Exxon or a BP, they think about a giant Goliath, you know, that's all powerful. And really the primary work, I think, in this movement is happens inside of our heads, is getting we the people to imagine that, in fact, this thing that they've given this superpower status to is something that doesn't even exist in the material world, that you can't photograph, that's made in our minds, that's merely a business structure. And what is the proper relationship between we the people and a legal fiction business structure that you can't even photograph? You know, and so what happened is, through the course of a weekend workshop that I would teach, that I teach all the time around the U.S., what happens is people's minds are tweaked in a pretty profound way, and they start revisioning what it means for, they're really, I mean, in reality, there's just us. There's just people. There's just nature. That's the only thing that's real. And the question is, what do we want our business structures to do for us? What do we want our government to do for us? And what do we want to prohibit our government and corporations doing? And it's really up to us. And, you know, we've been fed some pretty big lies about the corporation having this super status. One of the images I use in the workshop to help people imagine this is the Wizard of Oz in the great castle near the end of the film, when the little dog Toto, everybody's scared of the big man on the screen in the big hall. And the little dog runs off to the side and pulls a curtain aside, and there's this little man pulling levers. And he says, oh, don't pay any attention to me. Just pay attention to the Great Oz on the screen. You know, and the Great Oz on the screen is the legal fiction that we're supposed to all be cowering in front of. And really all that's going on is that there are decision makers behind the corporate veil, and they've been given incredible decision-making authority that overrules our decision-making authority as the citizenry. And that can end. That can change.
I think a lot of it just comes down to the conditioning of the people all around the world, not just America here, but people have been conditioned over the last 100-plus years that the federal government is the almighty mom or dad or whatever you want to call it.
When you say conditioning, I mean, you know, we've had two constitutions in the United States, and the second one we got illegally through a political coup, and it turned us into a strong federal, weak state and local system, which is not what the first constitution was at all. And so, you know, yes, it's conditioning, but it's also the law of the land. We have a constitution that states that federal trumps local, and so you can't go against it unless you break the law. I mean, that's the highest law of the land.
Yeah, and so then what you do is you come along and you say, okay, so that's the highest law of the land, but is there one higher law, which is in the American Constitution, which says that we have inalienable rights? And so is that the basis upon which you gazump that?
It is. I mean, we say that there's language in the preamble of the Constitution. There's language in every state constitution that makes it explicitly clear. It's remnant language from the American Revolution that says that we, the people, that consent of the governed is an absolute bottom line, and if you don't have consent of the governed, you don't have legitimate government. And many state constitutions say that the people at all times may alter, reform, or abolish the government in such manner as they may think proper. That actual language is in many state constitutions. So it's very, very clear that if we, the people, act as the sovereign, with government serving us, it's very difficult for government or corporations to push back. But for a century now, we've been acting like subordinates. We've been acting, you know, we've been taught that our real power is as consumers. So we organize consumer action campaigns rather than deciding that corporations need to be, you know, our subordinates serving us or dissolving them. I mean, it was interesting is after the American Revolution, you know, the 13 colonies of the United States were all crown corporations chartered by the king. And they were all constitutionalized into states, you know, with functioning governments. And what's interesting is that after that, the founding fathers recreate the corporation as a subordinate and give the state legislatures the authority to charter these institutions uniquely one at a time. And they're on very short leashes. But what I find most interesting is that after the revolutions in England and France and other countries that also had a lot of anti-corporate qualities to them, in those post-revolutionary societies, they don't recreate the business corporation at all. They actually go for a much more cooperative business structure. Whereas in this country, we go right back to the business, the for-profit corporation.
Yeah. Right. So what's the basic thing here is that we're conditioned to believe or socialized to believe that these are the highest laws of the land. And so this is how it's happening within the court system. But with the community rights movement, you're appealing to the sovereignty of the individual and the sovereignty of the community as having greater rights than corporations.
Not just greater rights than corporations. We say that rights are not for inanimate objects and they're not for legal fictions. The original corporate charters post-revolution gave privileges to the corporate fiction. Rights are for sentient beings. Privileges are for corporations. So that's what we need to get back to.
That's really important. So rights are for sentient beings and privileges are for corporations. So we, as sovereign people, as sovereign beings, actually, grant rights. And you can take that right across then into natural law and rights of the land and rights of birds and bees and things like that as well.
That's right. In fact, it's our movement that's really premiered rights of nature under law across the country. About 30 of the 160 ordinances that we've passed locally contain rights of nature language, and the local communities give themselves direct enforcement authority to represent nature in a court of law. And unlike our existing environmental laws that define nature as property, in our local lawmaking, the enforcement is very interesting. We give every resident legal standing, which is not normally how it works with environmental crimes. And the settlement has to actually put the ecological pieces back together. It's not some dollar figure that has no direct relevance to how expensive the damage is that needs to be fixed. So
I love it.
They've just got to put the ecological pieces back together. It doesn't matter what it costs, because it's violating nature's rights to not do so.
It is so powerful and so important, Paul, because you're actually building, I can just see this growing and growing, because you're actually building something based on truth, you know, on relative truth, which is the innate, inalienable rights of beings. And that is a fairness-based thing. And so what basically it seems to me, then I go, right, now there's a whole lot of court systems happening here that impose all these restrictions upon us. And so you have to fight all the way through, and then you're looking at big money and you're in Supreme Courts and things like that. And I'm looking at that both ways. I'm thinking, okay, so eventually a whole lot of money will be put behind this anyway, and I imagine you're getting an increasing amount of money as your movement builds. And then as you say, we won't be fighting one case at a time, but it will become an overruling law. Does that make sense to you, Paul?
Yeah, and in fact, what we do once we've passed a number of these ordinances within a state, we form a community rights network statewide, because we recognize that it's not sustainable in the long run for us to be passing laws that the state tells us we can't pass because they're illegal. That's not a sustainable movement.
Mm.
The next phase is that we start attacking unjust law at the state level directly through a state community rights network. We have 8 states in the U.S. now already have these networks in place. And one of them, Colorado, is already proposing a state constitutional amendment that would make it illegal for corporations to sue a local community that's simply trying to protect its health and welfare and ban corporate activities. So that's very exciting, and that will go before the voters sometime in the next year, year and a half, once they get it approved through the state elections process and collect the signatures.
Paul, have there been any communities that have, I mean, been in this movement that have stopped any eminent domain movements?
No, they haven't used eminent domain yet in any of, stopped existing, like, corporate or government eminent domains?
Well, both. Both, actually.
There have not been any of those, and there haven't been anywhere the public is using eminent domain itself for good.
Okay.
Not within our movement yet, no. But I'm excited about when it does happen.
Yeah. You going off somewhere?
I've just got to go away from the mic for a bit, Stephen. I'll only be about 2 minutes. But
okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can expand on other things. So I would like to see. I know that there was, well, this has been 20 plus years ago, but there was a couple of big corporations. Walmart came in, and another one I can't remember, but they're gone now. They went out of business, but they took a little kind of like a playland, if you know what I mean. There was a little place that had like a miniature golf, and they had a golf range where you could hit balls. They had go-kart area. They had it was just kind of like a kid's hangout, a playland. And Walmart came in and they said they wanted the land, and the locals bent over for them, and we've had a super Walmart there for like almost 20 years now, and it's gone. Kids don't have a local hangout anymore.
Yes, is all too common. And we haven't actually passed any ordinances to ban big box stores, but again, there are draft ordinances written on the CELDA site for that, and it's just a matter of time before people do that. The problem in this country is that activists think they have the authority to say no to corporate proposals, and they don't, because saying no violates various state laws and corporate rights. So what happens is you get one single issue revving up of a, you know, stop the so-and-so project campaign. And the public, because they think we live in a functioning democratic republic, they think they just have to organize to stop the thing. But the corporation has more rights than the community, and so almost always the thing is approved. And it goes in, and so you end up with a very disheartened public that just has given up, you know, that feel hopeless, and nobody ever actually gets to the core, which is why is it that corporations have more rights than we do? You know, what are these legal structures, and how do we stop ignoring them? And sadly, still, you know, virtually all activism in the United States today ignores this basic corporate rights history and story, and ignores the strategies that would challenge these corporate rights. And so it's a mostly dead-end game, most of our activism. It's pretty tragic.
So what you're really saying is that I've just noticed when you say rights, you're actually speaking about the rights that are being held in the eyes of the way of our very sort of legalized community. So I think maybe some people who are really into sovereign rights recognize their innate rights, and they do realize that they have rights, and they can trace them back through either the Irish or the English or the American Constitution. So, but when you're talking about rights in that context, you're talking about the rights that are the pervasive rights.
From the
top-down rights. You're talking about the top-down rights as opposed to the bottom-up rights.
I'm not quite understanding. We talk about inherent rights, that we the people have inherent rights of self-government, an inherent right to self-government.
Yes, Paul, but the way you just explained that a minute ago, it seems that we don't have any rights at all.
But that's why I'm arguing for Paul, so that you understand which direction he's coming from.
Yeah, within conventional legal frameworks, our rights are trumped by corporate power and elite and the 1% elite decision making, and so we have to step outside of conventional lawmaking. We call it one of the
right, but they're not.
I'm blanking on her name. In Maine, calls it. We have to step outside of the cage of allowable remedies. Gail Darrell in New Hampshire, a CELDEF organizer, that we've been stuck in this cage of allowable remedies for, you know, a very long time, working just through the regulatory and the zoning systems of law that are really, you know, designed to make sure that we can't succeed. So we step outside of these frameworks of law, and we create our own framework of law that recognizes our inherent right of self-government. And then the corporate attorneys then have to enter our framework of law to sue us, and it's a much more challenging lawsuit because it forces the corporate attorneys to make arguments about rights, which they would much rather not have to make in a public court.
It's incredibly transformational. Like, I just see, I'm excited about this.
Well, how about that break now, Jill?
Okay, Stephen.
Hey, we're at the hour here, and I want to give Paul a chance to go do something. So, all of us anyways, we've been going for an hour, and people have been in the chat for an hour. So, we'll be right back here. I've got about a 7-minute break put on. I'll be right back, everyone. All right, and we're back from the break, everyone. We still have Paul Cienfuego. We still have Jill. We are on PSN Radio. And we are also on People's Internet Radio, as well as my Cancel the Cabal stream. We were talking there during the break there, and Jill's gonna, well, go ahead and just ask him then, Jill.
Oh, well, Paul, one of the most exciting things that you are doing, is the community ordinances. And, I want to write a community ordinance, and I'm sure everybody does, you know, or have a community ordinance put in place. Would you like to, go a little bit more deeply, and for as long as you like? Tell me, how do you go about writing these community ordinances, and how I always think, right, then you create a jurisdictional conflict, and then you're back into the land of I need lawyers and big bucks. So how do you do the whole process of community ordinances, and how successful have they been?
Well, various steps there that you're asking about. So, I mean, the very first step is a community would contact either myself or the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, and the community group would say, we've got this problem, we've got the corporation wants to put in a fracking site or a factory farm or a big box store or whatever. I mean, it's just an endless list of attacks on our communities. And, ideally we're bypassing the whole regulatory dead end and we're going straight to rights-based lawmaking, so they need some basic training to get there. That's either my weekend workshop or CELDEF's democracy school training. And then, once they've gone through this basic training, they meet with CELDEF's attorneys and organizers, and they ask the local community very, very specifically, what is it you're trying to prohibit? What kind of rights do you want to establish in your local community? And from this, usually quite a few months of community meetings, a list of requirements is established, and the CELDEF attorneys take that and they create a first draft, which they don't charge for, and it goes back and forth, draft after draft, and many communities might go through 15 or 20 drafts before they're ready. And then in about 25 or 30 states in the U.S., we have the right to pass laws directly through the ballot box locally, initiative and referendum. And in those states, what usually happens is, after the law is written, you file it with your local elections official, and you get it on the ballot. And that's one of the points that the powers that will fight you and try to stop you from getting it on the ballot. And there's a number of examples. There's a couple communities in Oregon where, for ideological reasons, the county elections attorney has forced the local community rights group to file edited ordinance after edited ordinance, continuing to claim that the ordinance doesn't meet the standards of local lawmaking. But it's usually ideological in nature, because in these 25 or 30 states, you have the right to put whatever you want on the ballot. In some cases, like in Spokane, Washington, where every 2 years they ran it on the ballot until they finally they were going to win last November, and instead county government and a bunch of business institutions sued them to keep them on the ballot. And won in the courtroom. So now our campaign is suing the group that kept them off the ballot, saying it violated the voters' rights. So we're kind of stuck in court on that one for a while. But ultimately, in a vast majority of the 160 communities in 9 states, you've got the ordinances have been passed directly by the elected officials, city councils, county council, etc. And in some cases, like in Mora County, New Mexico, where a community was just absolutely committed to passing a ban on all hydrocarbon removal, coal mining, oil drilling, fracking, all banned in one ordinance. They didn't have the votes in the county government to do it, so they had to wait for an election cycle, and they voted in 2 new people in the next election so that they'd actually have enough votes to pass a community bill of rights there that bans hydrocarbon removal. It's a right to water ordinance. What I haven't had a chance to say is that all of the ordinances are framed as a right to a ... They're rights-based lawmaking. So if you're trying to stop fracking or oil drilling, those ordinances tend to be called right to water ordinances. And the legal framework is that you've established a locally enforceable right to water for people and nature in your community. And fracking violates your community's right to water, and therefore fracking has to be prohibited because it's a direct violation of the ordinance. A number of New Hampshire communities, they've passed the right to a sustainable energy future has been passed through the annual town meeting process in 4 New Hampshire towns. They're trying to stop a massive electric transmission line through their communities. From Quebec, from Canada, called Northern Pass. They passed, the annual town meetings, house. Most small New England communities still do their lawmaking. The whole town shows up once a year for a full day, and they vote in public, hands in the air. In Maine, they're trying to stop a NAFTA-type corporate superhighway from being built through a number of communities called the East-West Corridor. So a bunch of communities have passed the right to a local infrastructure, or right to a sustainable infrastructure, where they legally define sustainable infrastructure as only the infrastructure that is democratic oversight. So something that's corporate doesn't meet the definition of a sustainable infrastructure, and it's banned. Here in Oregon, we've got 2 communities that are passing the right to a local food system ordinance through the ballot box. One is in the signature gathering phase already. One is still fighting the local attorneys from the county elections office. It would ban GMO agriculture entirely in two counties in Oregon. And the one that's collecting signatures currently will be on the ballot in November. In southern Oregon, we've got the right against the right to a pesticide-free future, I think it's called, that would ban pesticide spraying on forest and farmlands by corporations or governments, on and on and on. So this is kind of that's the framework. And then the communities, you know, is a right to a whatever specifically. And then I think one of the things that's most exciting for me about this is that the communities then create their own enforcement authority. So they don't count on the city or county government that may not be in support of what the community has passed. They create their own direct local enforcement authority as the public.
That's amazing. That's a very fascinating sort of a thing. That almost ties back to Brehan Law, because it's obviously looking for a fair outcome.
Yes, that's right.
Mm. And so how do they, what sort of enforcement do they come up? I do remember, just segueing slightly, that there is one community that you were involved with, Paul, that made some right that they couldn't be arrested.
Yes, that's so, Josephine County in southern Oregon, which was the pesticide ordinance. They built something into their enforcement language, which was a pleasant surprise for all of the rest of the communities in this movement. They said that once the law has been passed and it's been placed into law, that any resident shall have the authority, shall have the right to commit civil disobedience to defend the existing law, and that civil disobedience shall be considered fully legal.
I love it.
It's really creative. And a lot of community ordinances say that if a court overrules the ordinance, that the county or city or town is required to go back into public meetings and decide what their next steps are going to be to defend their ordinance rather than abandon it. So, you know, it's just a whole variety of creative ways of thinking about, you know, what does it look like for me, the people, to start standing up and imagining that we are in charge again. And even if the powers that be, you know, are going to push back as hard as they possibly can, you know, the first step is for us to start acting as if we're powerful, as if we're in charge, as if we have authority to govern ourselves. So it's really, the biggest shift is in our heads.
Absolutely. And you use the word imagining a lot. And I think that's just, it is a very important word.
Yeah, it's interesting that you're pointing that out, because I think I don't actually normally use that word, but it's a really perfect word. I should use it.
Well, I noticed it in a video, the one you did in Oregon recently, a more recent video with the really funky band that opened the meeting, and you finished it with a song, that particular video.
Yeah,
and you said imagine this and imagine that, and I think this is the thing, is to keep ourselves going, is to imagine what we can do next, rather than, oh God, we hit a brick wall. I remember I fought for and lost about 20 years ago against the closure of a local school, and I really only lost because the government had come in, and I actually won. I went and lobbied a local politician, and he said, yes, your school will stay open. And it got printed in the local newspaper as staying open. And then the teachers actually jettisoned the school for their own job security.
Wow.
Yeah, just sold out. And I actually, that night, I went home with some of those teachers who'd voted against me. And I literally lay on the floor under the kitchen table. I couldn't even stay on my chair. I was wiped out by it. Whereas when you have processes in place, what to do next, you know, imagining what happens if we hit this wall and creative ways around it. I think that's really just another fabulous thing about this movement that you're involved with and leading, Paul.
I mean, it really is incredibly exciting. And, you know, even the community up in New Hampshire, the communities that passed the right to a sustainable energy future, they made a legal definition for sustainability. And it was very intriguing. Actually,
think we have time. I can just read the definition. It's a long paragraph, but okay.
I'd love it. Well, we'd be beautiful. You're the words of wisdoms that we're drinking from. Please keep going.
So, they have a legal definition for unsustainable energy systems. So this is what they're going to ban in these four New Hampshire communities. And I think you know, before I even read the paragraph, the idea of defining authority, which is a very powerful thing, you know, that the 1% has had finding authority forever. And what does it look like for we, the people of a local place, to imagine that we have defining authority and to actually write laws that we enforce and to create legal definitions that suit us rather than the kinds of definitions we usually end up with that are kind of the 1%'s definitions. So here's a community majority's legal definition of unsustainable energy systems. It means those systems that are controlled by state and federal energy policies rather than community-controlled energy policies. Hydroelectric power and industrial-scale wind power when it's not locally or municipally owned and operated. Energy systems using fossil fuels, including but not limited to coal, natural gas, petroleum products, nuclear and radioactive materials, and other fuel sources that are non-renewable, or which produce toxins and substances that cause injury to humans or natural communities and ecosystems, or that are in violation of residents' right to a sustainable energy future. The phrase shall also include any energy system which violates the rights of human and natural communities under this ordinance or under other laws.
So, you still reading? You're going.
Yeah, so even wind, you know, it's very interesting. So they say even wind turbines, we're going to call unsustainable energy systems unless they're democratically controlled.
Okay. So can you just sort of wrap my head around, I'm trying to wrap my head around that. I just don't think I'm focusing strongly enough. I didn't quite get it. What are you saying about alternative systems, about being democratically what? I think I missed that word.
Democratically controlled. So, you know, most people.
Oh, yeah.
Energy movement would say, oh, yeah, wind turbines are democratically controlled. It would be easy to say no to them. The community, you know, coal-fired power plant, sure, that's a clear no. But what's wrong with wind? And what the folks in Sugar Hill, New Hampshire, and Plymouth, New Hampshire, and other communities are saying is we're sick and tired of energy policy being made by corporations. So even if it's wind turbines, we're going to call that unsustainable energy unless we have control over it. If it's a business corporation, we have no authority over it. We're still going to call it unsustainable energy, even though it's wind. And the organizer in New Hampshire, she calls it industrial wind, that what we need to do is get away from industrial wind, which is an interesting phrase, and start decentralizing wind turbines, not having, you know, giant wind farms that are hundreds of miles from where the power is needed.
Yeah, I get that. Yep. And also because some people have real issues with what they think is, the science is still out on it about, what's the word for it? A type of noise that wind turbines put out and a lot of people are worried about. Well, we had big issues here. We put a couple of turbines up here in my community, and we have our turbines do generate enough for the town. But there were a couple of farmers who were directly owned the land adjacent to the turbine, and they were very upset about it. And it's so hard. Go on.
Yesterday in Portland, I was just walking by a. I'm trying to remember. I don't even remember exactly where I was, but I was surprised to see three giant turbines on top of a skyscraper at the edge of downtown Portland. I thought that was really like, why not?
Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah, there's a name for it anyway. So what you're basically saying is, and I'd like you to say a bit more about it, is the importance and the future for these community-based rights to usurp what at the moment are corporate rights. Would you like to talk about what you envisage or imagine there, Paul?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, we're up against these structures of law. So when you're challenging corporate constitutional rights, you know, even your kind of conventional environmental activist attorneys will say, well, you really can't do that. That's settled law. So this is a movement that's really stepping entirely outside of settled law and saying, you know, we're not going to accept it as settled law anymore.
Not sure exactly what to say about it, other than you know, that the ordinances are drafted in such a way to force a kind of, we're forcing a certain kind of legal argument from the lips of the corporate attorneys, that, you know, that if they sue us, it's not about energy, it's not about fracking, it's not about big box stores, it's about rights. It's about who should decide in our local community, a community majority of the people who live here, and the elected officials, or a legal fiction, you know, and why, you know, how crazy is it that we've, for all of these years, allowed a legal fiction to usurp authority to decide the future of our community? You know, what is the vision? You know, in conventional activism, we're always asking ourselves, you know, what are we trying to stop? And if we stretch that a little bit more, occasionally it's, what do we think we can get? And what we say is, you know, neither of those is really what a sovereign people would do. A sovereign people would ask, what do we want? And let's go for that. And let's assume that what we want is reachable, because we're going to act as if we're in charge. We're going to mobilize ourselves and start acting like citizens again instead of consumers.
I just love that. That's very creative. And so that's actually a perfect segue back to the original constitutions that you know some stuff about, and then the amendments. Would you like to speak about that a little bit more, Paul? With the original constitutions, we were talking when we were offline about the original constitutions, and also when corporations first got personhood. That's a very interesting concept, when corporations got personhood, and how they then deviated from the original constitutions, and all these extra sort of things happened.
Yeah, so these are pretty set pieces. I'll do the early history piece first.
Okay, thanks.
Try to do it really briefly. So, you know, we have an authentic revolution against the monarchs, and you know, yes, this authentic revolutionary struggle is happening, you know, on top of a massive slavery campaign that's incredibly genocidal, and a massive massive racism against the native people that are already here by the millions. So it's a pretty complicated revolutionary moment, full of a lot of but nonetheless, we have an American Revolution to create true liberty among the folks who are fighting in the Revolutionary War. And what we end up with is a truly revolutionary constitution, and it's called the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union. It's a very different constitution than what we have now. In the original constitution, there was no U.S. Supreme Court, there were no standing state courts, so there was no court that could overrule a legislature and say you can't pass a law like that. There was no U.S. Senate, which is kind of like the British House of Lords, you know, it's the group that can overrule the people's house, so that didn't exist. And there was no executive branch, there was no president in the original Constitution. And the goal was not to have a strong federal system, the goal was to have a decentralized system of law. So states had ultimate governing authority, and all the federal government did was host meetings of the states in Congress assembled. So the states would meet in Congress, and somebody called the president, who only was a facilitator, would lead those meetings. And that was pretty much the entire role of the federal government, the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union. And at that point, so states have ultimate governing authority, and the United States is simply seen as a confederation of sovereign states. And local governments also had profound amount of decision-making authority at that time. So the rising merchant class, call the 1%, was not interested in that kind of constitution. They wanted to be able to replicate empire as possible here. And so they basically organized a political coup. The short version of the story is that they first called a meeting in to amend the Constitution to give the federal government more power, and only 5 of 13 states even bothered to send a representative, so there wasn't much they could do there. And they proposed what they called a grand convention in Philadelphia next year, and all 13 states came. And but the states were very suspicious of this grand convention, and they were under very, very strict mandate simply to amend the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, and instead they threw it out entirely, which was illegal. That's not how you change the Constitution. And they wrote one from scratch that took power away from the states and gave us a strong federal system with a court, you know, with standing state and federal courts, with the Senate, with an executive branch. And so that happens. We only end up with our first revolutionary constitution for about 8 or 10 years. And the public so furious when they read the new constitution, because the people had to ratify, again, all 13 states had to ratify the new one. And when it went, when the document went to the 13 states for ratification, the people who met were so outraged at this thing that they refused to ratify it until the founding fathers had promised that there would be rights built into the constitution, because the new second constitution had nothing at all about liberty and rights. It was all about property and commerce. It was kind of a bureaucrat constitution. It's very strange. The constitution, you know, if you don't realize that the amendments are added years later and the amendment rights are, you think, what a strange document. How would you end up with a revolutionary struggle for justice? How would you end up with this commerce and property document? Because most people don't even realize we had another constitution first. So that's kind of a very, very brief synopsis of the early constitutional history. And, let's see. And then the corporate rights piece is a whole nother interesting historical piece that the Supreme Court, again, you know, we didn't have a Supreme Court until we had the second constitution, and the entire history of the growth of constitutional rights for corporations is the story of the Supreme Court making decisions. There's hardly any other part of government that's involved. It's been a Supreme Court creation for almost 200 years, starting in 1819. The Supreme Court starts the language we use is the Supreme Court finds corporate rights in the Constitution. And we say finds because the word corporation isn't in any of these documents. So they look clauses of the Constitution and they say, aha, corporation should have rights there. And so.
Now that came about because, there was, that didn't just first begin with Henry Ford, did it?
No, the Henry Ford is early 20th century.
Yeah, because that's cars. Yeah, go on.
The very interesting Michigan Supreme Court case that Henry Ford is named in. Mm. Yeah, you know, and so whoever is in charge, whoever has defining authority gets to define what a corporation is. And again, I realize that, so it's not until a 1919 Michigan Supreme Court decision that a corporation redefined yet again as something where the directors are required to maximize shareholder return as their primary duty.
Yeah, and they based that on people's rights, did they? They were basically saying, well, I believe from that you said that Henry Ford wanted to give benefit to the people out of cars and make cheap cars, and then his group of people in the corporation said, hang on, we are a group of people, therefore we have rights as a group of people, and they called them corporate rights. Is that more or less how it happened?
No, it's not correct.
It was good.
it was the stockholders. So Henry Ford wanted to raise his employees' wages because they were making cars they could not afford to buy, and they wanted to own the cars they were making. And so he was making so much profit for Ford Motor Company, he thought, it's a win-win all around. I'll raise their wages, they'll buy the cars. And his stockholders sued him. It didn't have anything to do with corporate persons at all. It was human beings who were the stockholders suing the president of the company, saying you can't raise the wages of the workers because that violates, you know, what ended up being called the stockholder primacy case to this day, that the primary purpose of a for-profit business corporation is to maximize return to shareholders. And up until then, that wasn't the law, but that's what the Michigan Supreme Court's case stated, and that's been the requirement ever since for business corporations. So again, whoever has power gets to define what a corporation is, and the definition keeps changing over time. So you end up, you know, constitutional rights start in 1819 through the Supreme Court, and not until 1886 do corporations win personhood in a particular decision around a railroad corporation.
And so
personhood, and they start looking at the word person in the various amendments to the Constitution, and they start trying to convince the Supreme Court to grant one new corporate right after another based on the further amendments, and they win over and over and over, and they still are. There's a court case right now in the Supreme Court where I'm guessing in the next few months the Supreme Court will rule that the corporate legal fiction has the right of religious freedom, which is completely absurd. But going to be
it is completely absurd, and this is the thing, because it's just such a interesting sort of argument to work out about the rights of corporations as opposed to the rights of the individual, and it's a very pedantic way of playing with words to take away the individual dignity and the importance of the individual.
Indeed, yeah. So this is really... Oh, go ahead.
No, I'm just humming and hawing. Keep going.
Well, I was just going to kind of take us back to all of the incredible communities that are taking their rights back around the country. I've been flying to the Midwest states, to the farm states of Iowa and Wisconsin and Minnesota every 2 to 3 months for the last year. It's a whole new front in the work. There haven't been any at all, but... you know, everybody's heard of fracking these days, and what most people don't realize is that fracking sites require an enormous amount of a very particular special kind of sand. Everybody's heard it, they need chemicals and water, but people don't realize they also need a special sand. And this sand is being blasted out of hills all over Iowa, Wisconsin, Minnesota farmland.
Terrible. Keep going.
Yeah, so I've been helping farm communities across these three states that are watching their hills basically be blown up down to valley level, and then the sand being put in 100 car trains and taken 1,000 miles to fracking sites. I mean, it's obscene. And the conventional...
It is obscene.
You can't actually stop these because the mining corporations have the right to do what they're doing, and they have the right to transport it. And so within conventional frameworks of law, there's nothing you can do. And so... communities are learning from scratch about the community rights movement. You know, I'm going and leading workshop after workshop, and it's very exciting. So now,
And this is why you have to tie it back to nature law, nature's rights.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Mm. And so that's what you use, is it? How do I stop fracking?
Well, so basically you would pass at the local or county level, you would pass an ordinance, you'd work with CELDEF attorneys, and you'd pass a law that guarantees the human and non-human residents of the place a right to water, and we would recognize that fracking violates everybody's right to water, and so you would prohibit that corporate activity, and then you'd build local enforcement authority into the ordinance, into the local law, and you'd pass it either through a public vote or through the local elected officials.
And you were saying that with these local enforcement authorities, would you like to talk a little bit more about the local enforcement authorities and the sort of consequences and enforcements that people are sort of imagining and doing?
And it's really, I can't really report very much because it's really the new edge for our community rights ordinances. For the first 14 years, it's simply said, you know, corporations shall not do this, and you know we're going to fine the company if they do. And the problem is that you then need cooperative local government and judges, right, to do the enforcement, which frequently is not going to do the job. And so, really, just the new edge for our ordinances. There's only one other example so far in the country where people are thinking outside the box around enforcement, because if we're claiming that we have authority to self-govern, then we need to start figuring out what that means in terms of direct local enforcement, something we've never really thought about as a citizenry in modern era anyway. And there's one other exciting example that I can offer in State College, Pennsylvania, which is where Pennsylvania State University is. It's a small town, huge university. The community decided they wanted to stop any more pipelines from being built underneath their community. They were trying to stop a natural gas pipeline going to the university there. Mm-hmm. Their city council and mayor both came out completely opposed to what the public wanted. The public ran it through a vote, and they won the ban on pipelines. And the city council and the mayor continued to act as if the law was illegal and unconstitutional, which it is, and therefore they were going to ignore it. And the pipeline company and the university acted as if it was illegal and unconstitutional, which it is. And so they were going to ignore the law and go right ahead and and run the mine. And the response from the public, realizing that they're going to have to figure out a different kind of enforcement, since they'd already passed the law overwhelmingly, is they called on, they called the Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street and Greenpeace offices, and they asked for nonviolent direct action trainers, workshop leaders, to come to State College, Pennsylvania, and teach the public how to do civil disobedience. And they came, and they trained a large number of people in the community, and then the powers that be finally blinked, and they canceled the pipeline because they could see the writing on the wall that they were going to have their own townsfolk who had already passed a law saying no, physically blocking the building of the pipeline. And that that was, you know, I can imagine what the mayor must have been thinking. You know, at that point, they're going to throw his ass out pretty quick if he continues to ignore the law that the public passed. And so all the powers that be blinked. It was a very interesting outcome. And but this is really very new, you know, for us to be thinking about direct enforcement.
I wonder how, go on.
No, just it. That's really it. Just what do we want? How do we want to enforce our laws? We're used to thinking we have no power, and, you know, we're going to elect people this stuff out. Well, what if we figure it out? You know, boy, is that, what if we get ourselves public space and figure it out for ourselves?
Yeah, absolutely. And the sort of grassroots approach is so connected with, you see, I often look at sovereignty, right? And we end up in sovereign situations, you know, recognizing our own sort of divinity or our own sovereignty or whatever word you want to, our own inalienable rights. But then we keep coming against this brick wall of people who don't actually understand, see that in me, for example, you know, so someone does not see me as a sovereign. And so then, the mainstream sort of attitude being, that, they can enforce something upon me. So what this is doing, from what I see is in terms of marrying sovereignty with, community rights is it's gathering a whole group of people who recognize their own sovereignty and then strengthening the numbers by making it some sort of, community acknowledgement of our own sovereignty and our right to self-determination. How do you relate to that?
Yeah, and I think you hit the nail on the head. It's not just, you know, there's a citizen sovereignty movement in the United States that's very much about individual rights, property rights, and that's not what we are at all. We're about community majorities. What does the community majority want?
And that is interesting because when you look at direct democracy and how direct citizen-based referendum functions in Switzerland, a lot of people are saying one of the, or some people say, the flaws in citizen-based referendum is one of the weaknesses in who's actually going to stand up and, you know, maybe you get a whole lot of morons leading it. You know what I mean? So, like, if we could, I could go and have a group vote. Here's a debate here. I could go and have a group vote with a whole lot of people who I don't agree with. And so there could be a whole lot of, well, it's happening now. A whole lot of stupid people get to take the power because there's the power in numbers. So basically, we need the language and the intellectual concepts to recognize rights, isn't it? We have to bring it back to an analysis of ethics and virtue ethics as well as utilitarian ethics. What, don't you agree, Paul?
I do. And, you know, I don't think that people are. I think people are made stupid, and they're made stupid by a corporate elite system that, you know, that where our news and our analysis and, you know, what we're taught is important in the world comes to us from for-profit business corporations. And, you know, I also have a whole, I also do a separate workshop about what it would look like to use the same analysis about corporations as our legal subordinates that have to serve us or we revoke their charter. You know, what would it look like if we started treating our media corporations as our subordinates and we instruct the people who run our media corporations to either do a really decent job providing us comprehensive news and analysis, or it's time for us to dissolve company and replace it with a more responsible set of editors and publishers, you know, because I, you know, that's how people become stupid is the system of, you know, I mean, we're entertained to death rather than educated and, you know, and taught what's really going on in the world. So, I mean, you know, there's a lot of layers to the problem. I mean, it's a crisis on a lot of different, in a lot of different ways.
It is. It is multidimensional. And, you know, when I strip it back to basics, I just go, okay, so, you know, my innate nature, your innate nature, that's some type of wisdom. That's a more of a sort of, an insightful sort of wisdom, but then the intellectual wisdom, like we have to grow both those wisdoms, the sort of primordial sort of, insight sort of wisdom, as well as the intellectual wisdom. And it's not, neither of those things are taught, do we focus on enough, you know, with logic and reasoning, and ethics, rights of why somebody, We need to analyze why people have these rights and make it part of our conversation, which has just completely vanished with the mainstream media, as you were saying.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't even know if I can allow the mainstream media to be the mainstream media. You know, I mean, it just shows you how colonized our minds have become, that we allow crappy news and analysis to even, you know, be something we call mainstream news.
And that's a very interesting thing. That's right. That we do the colonized mind. You actually gave a talk on the colonized mind. Would you like to talk about how our minds are colonized? Because even within People's Internet Radio or any group I go into, our minds get colonized in different ways, don't they? But it is still that sort of top-down image that we see that sort of affects our mirror neurons and the way we think. We do stop thinking creatively, and we are more like, I can't think of the word for it, but our minds are colonized. Would you like to talk about how to avoid that sort of mental construct a little bit, Paul?
It's also, it's not something that happens overnight, and it's not something I think that anyone can do alone. It really requires reflective learning processes in groups with people that you trust, I think, just like the consciousness raising movements that women were involved in the '70s, realizing that, you know, the craziness they were experiencing in their private lives wasn't craziness at all. It was actually a societal phenomenon that they were all experiencing. And, you know, Paulo Freire has this wonderful, phrase, the conscious oppressed and the unconscious oppressed, that, you know, I do an exercise in my weekend workshops that looks at what does it mean to be, you know, here we are, you know, a mostly white, mostly very privileged group of people who come to my workshops across the United States. And, you know, we've got access to so many goodies and so many electronic toys, it's hard to think of ourselves as oppressed. And yet, you know, we have almost no decision-making authority at all within the conventional legal framework. And we've kind of, you know, we're so well entertained, we barely even know that. We just know that when we try to get active, nothing seems to work to improve the situation. So, let's see, I just lost my train of thought. Where was I headed with this?
Well, we're talking about how, the colonized mind.
Gosh.
It's all right. It's a good sign, I think. It shows you're a lateral thinker. But you were talking about how women had to come to the realization of their own lack of empowerment, and how we were being fed this sort of vision of what women are in society.
Same thing has to happen for us. And, you know, Paulo Freire would describe privileged white Americans as the unconscious oppressed, and that the first thing we need to recognize is that we're oppressed. And once we realize we're oppressed in all the ways that we are oppressed, you know, living in a corporate state, not the democracy that we were taught that we live in, you know, then we slowly, with great effort, become the conscious oppressed. Because not until you actually know that you're oppressed are you going to do anything about your oppression. So, you know, there's kind of a number of stages towards, you know, revolutionary consciousness. And I think that the community rights movement, you know, is a small piece of that, because it teaches people, as, you know, once a corporation's attorneys attack a local ordinance, and the residents of the local community hear at mouths of the corporate attorneys that corporations actually have more rights than in the town. So the people in the town just sit down and shut up. So have no real self-authority that needs to be recognized and respected. people are outraged when they hear that. And the crazy thing is, it's actually true under law, but it's a cognitive dissonance moment for Americans in their local communities. When this happens, it generates a new kind of level of democratic uprising. That's the goal. So far, I think it's been pretty effective that, people think that the democratic system that we're living in is working just fine. It needs to be fixed around the edges. But to learn that it's actually designed to exclude, basically 90% of us from any relevant decision-making power is quite a shock to people. And in our movement, they get to hear it out of the mouths of corporate lawyers, have designed it.
Stephen, how much longer do we have, and is it time for a song? And answer me that first, will you, Stephen? I don't know where you are. You seem to have gone quiet on us.
Now we got about 6-7 minutes left.
Is that all we have left?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Do you have any questions you want to ask Paul? Otherwise, I have some.
Go ahead.
Do you have a question, Stephen?
Go ahead, Jill.
Okay, so, Paul, it's really amazing what you're doing. I think it's quite hard for some people to actually cotton on. I think, just like with anything, we have to work on it. It is multi-pronged and multi-dimensional approach that we need to take towards our own self-empowerment and freedom, because there's so many different areas in which we're being oppressed. So to find the language to be able to negotiate with people and change the more global mindset is a very important point. And I think that your stories about the people who are having success with the community ordinances very inspiring, because I know, so some people think there's nothing you can do about fracking, yet you're showing that there's a lot that can actually be done about fracking. I'd like to bring it back to, so basically we're looking at community rights, nature rights. Would you like to sum up all the things that one needs to sort of keep in mind when one is trying to transform their own community and also on a more global level?
in a couple minutes? Well, so again, the movement is, it's really about the key question, who should decide the key decisions that affect a community at the local level? We, the people who live there, are a corporate legal fiction, a corporate it. So, who's in charge, who decides? That's kind of the core meme for the movement. And then, 160 communities in 9 states over 14 years and climbing fast. And every one of our ordinances does 3 pretty remarkable things. They strip corporations all of their constitutional rights. They enshrine a local government's, a local people's inherent right to govern itself. And they ban a particular corporate activity that the ordinance is about. And maybe it'd be good to give some resources before the interview's over.
I'd love that.
So, again, the primary public use law firm has helped to create this movement and is really leading it at this point is called the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. CELD as in dog, F as in Frank .org is their website. And on that website, you can see all of the ordinances that they've passed, organized by categories. Very interesting to actually read these ordinances that don't have any legalese in them at all. They're very readable with a high school education. You'll understand every word, which is kind of exciting for law, kind of rare for law.
Yep. Yep.
And then my website is paulcienfuegos.com. And you'll see the spelling of my name on the website. So paulcienfuegos.com. And through me, you can sign up for my Community Rights Update, which is a newsletter that will come to you through email periodically, a couple times a month. And then if you want kind of a quick and dirty introduction to this movement beyond those 2 websites, you can go to YouTube and type in 3 words, Community Rights TV. We have a channel there with a couple dozen interviews and speeches that people can check out, Community Rights TV on YouTube. And you can subscribe on that page, and every time we post another video, you'll get notice of it. So those are good introductory avenues for finding out more about community rights movement. And yeah, I've kind of put my whole life into it and figure I have another 10 or 15 active years, and we'll see how far we can get. And even if it turns out that, I mean, I'm very pessimistic about the climate change crisis being avertible at this point. Mm. You know, there's so many crises that we face that are so advanced already. But my feeling is that even if the best that we can do is ultimately get thousands of these ordinances passed across the country and help Americans to start the process of ecological and economic collapse in a more democratic way, rather than end up in civil war against each other, it will have been worth our efforts.
Well, that's massive. That's a mind-boggling thought, but it is actually a reality that you have to look at that. That's a horrible, it's really freaky place to be looking at it from, but it's probably very true, Paul.
So, you know, one way or the other, the work is worth it. And, you know, we've never really had a true democratic culture in this country, and it's about time we had one. You know, we've been quote-unquote exporting democracy for a long time in the United States, which has been a disaster.
Absolutely. Well, look, you've inspired me, literally and truly. I've got some local people, and we are going to do something about the use of our water. We already have within our council sort of, well, whatever the words are. I've just really got so many words I have to learn, but our council documents anyway, saying that we want to be sustainable. So we already have a basis there to sort of argue it on. And I imagine, you know, usually there are always words that we can pick up on that will help us be able to find a way through. But it is very much going through the eye of the needle, isn't it?
Much, yeah. Yeah, and I'm in touch with the CELDA folks directly through their website and ask about what they're doing in Australia, because I know that they're working with a number of groups there now.
I would love to do that, Paul. Yeah, go on, Stephen.
Well, I was just going to say that's a good place to end it there, Jill.
Is it?
Yeah. Time's
okay,
up.
Okay, then.
Show's over. So we thank you for coming on, Paul.
You are very, very welcome. Yeah, thanks for the opportunity.
Oh, Paul, thank you so much for what you're doing. I think a lot of people really can't, you know, I just hope more people can actually cotton on and realize the power in this grassroots movement, because and we the people taking back our power on many different levels, as well as on so-called legal levels. I think it's an important part of the process. You know, we can't just switch from being completely ruled by corporations to being completely sovereign. We have to use many different levels on which the rules apply, or the so-called rules apply, and explode them from within. And I think what you're doing is incredibly important. And thank you so much for agreeing to this interview. And it's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure as well for me.
Yes, yeah, it
thank
has.
Thank you so much for the time.
And have a good night over there.
Yes. Sunny afternoon in Oregon.
Oh, well, afternoon. That's right. It's just going on 5 p.m., isn't it?
Six.
I'm sorry. Yes. Looked at my clock wrong. So, everyone, that's my show for tonight. I'll see everyone Friday night, same time. For Jill, this is Steve. This is Kent LaCabal. So, good night, everyone.